Well, good morning, everyone. I'm proud to be here today, joined by Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor. You're going to hear from some of our legislators. And then I think most importantly today, you're going to hear from Minnesotans on a topic that impacts every single one of our families, the cost of medical care and the medical debt and the damage that is done after that. I want to applaud the Attorney General and the legislators here and the advocates. We've been working quite some time to put together a comprehensive package that protects Minnesotans around this issue. Look, I think for each and every one of us, you don't have to go very far to find your own personal story. Many of you have heard me talk about this when I was a teenager, my little brother was 8 and my father was dying and in the hospital on life support. Those last 10 days ended up putting my mom back to work for 20 years to try and pay off medical debt, debt that is reported to the credit bureau that can destroy your credit, hamper your ability to pay rent, to get a lease, or to be able to get a car loan. And those types of things do nothing. There's many different types of debt. Credit card debt to buy a television is one thing. Debt because you had a heart attack or were hit by a car or have an illness is an entirely different thing. And the idea that we're charging massive interest on that, that we're reporting it to the credit bureau and we're destroying lives over it makes absolutely no sense. It does not help the healthcare system. It certainly doesn't help Minnesotans. So I'm going to let the experts up here talk about some of the details in this, but this is smart legislation. It's been enacted in several other states. And what we've seen is we've seen people then get better access to care, not being hampered from going in because they have a bill that was already there. And then the one for me that is just unconscionable, reporting to the credit bureau and ruining people's credit over a debt that was assumed by no fault of their own. That makes absolutely no sense. And I think here in Minnesota, we need to make sure that that doesn't happen. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Lieutenant Governor Flanagan.
Thank you so much, Governor. I'm grateful to be able to be here in space today with these leaders, with the Attorney General, and with folks who are going to tell you their personal story. As the Governor said, many of us have personal stories. Growing up, I've talked about being on Medicaid, and it was really a lifesaver for me and for my mom, for our family. But when my mom was able to go back to school, get a better paying job, it bumped her up into a new financial space. And that was a good thing, but it also meant that our health insurance was really expensive. I was a kid who had asthma. There were some times when I was in the hospital more than I was out. I remember I had a tutor because I missed so much school, and she went trick-or-treating for me one year because I was hospitalized. And that was a really big struggle for my mom, just to have her baby, who was sick and struggled to breathe and hospitalized. But the financial impact on our family was significant. My mom needed to file for bankruptcy because of medical debt. And that really took us a long time to recover. And so when we talk about this, when we have the power to do something about it for Minnesotans across the state, we absolutely have to act. I remember feeling guilty that I got sick, right? And there are kids, there are families who feel that too. They shouldn't have to. So I'm really grateful that, you know, we have an opportunity really to ultimately help families save money, to build wealth, to feel secure, because only then can we really be successful as a state. So I am so hopeful about this legislation and grateful to our partners in the legislature and those who are willing to tell their stories, because it's through that storytelling, I think, that we can change hearts and minds and really make a difference. And I'm grateful for the partnership that we have with our Attorney General, Keith Ellison, and I'm going to turn it over to him.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor and Governor Walz. Again, what an honor to be working with you on issues so critical to the people of the state of Minnesota. And also, it's a great honor to be working with our legislators and our advocates who fight for people every day. Minnesotans work hard to provide for themselves and their families. We're a state where most folks play by the rules and meet their responsibilities. But when life throws up roadblocks, we can stumble. That's human. That's severe illness, injury, losing your job, unexpected repair bills, divorce, medical bills, and all of these things that lead us to be in a position where we are behind on debt. Now, don't get me wrong, if you borrow money, you should pay it back. We all agree on that. But, we should also all agree that we shouldn't punish people for getting sick. We should all agree that debt collection systems that make it harder for people to pay back what they owe does nobody any good. And we should all agree that debt collection shouldn't create even more debt. The debt collection process should be fair. It should be dignified. People trying to catch up and pay off their debts should be able to do so without being exploited or dragged down into poverty. Instead, our system is full of unfair loopholes and policies that make it harder for people to repay their debts, even when they are trying to and doing their very best. It doesn't have to be this way. My office has been working for months to work with advocates, the governor's office, and everyone who believes in a fair economy to pull together a bill led by our authors, Senator Liz Bolden and Representative Liz Ryer. And we think we have one. And this is the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. Believe in it. This bill aims to correct the flaws in our debt collection system, making it fairer and easier for Minnesotans to work their way out of debt. It strengthens the guardrails in three important areas: medical debt, which is the focus today, but also wage garnishment and collections. Let me talk about medical debt for a moment. Fairness in medical debt is what we are focusing on here today. That's our topic, that's our focus. Medical debt isn't like a mortgage or a car loan. You apply for those, you seek them out. A lender assesses your credit worthiness, offers you an amount or an interest rate and a term, then you sign. That's the way that goes. But you don't apply for medical debt. You incur it because you have no other choice, because you need emergency care, because you're suddenly diagnosed with a life-threatening condition or chronic illness. You don't have the luxury of planning out how much you want to borrow, when you want to borrow it, or how you're going to pay it back. Medical debt is unique, so it should have a unique response and unique provisions in the law. Here are a few of some provisions concerning medical debt in the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act. The Debt Fairness Act bans medical providers from refusing to care for someone who has an outstanding bill with a provider. Nobody should delay or be refused important medical care only because they're struggling with their bills. Denying care to people with outstanding bills creates a debt spiral. People who are denied or delayed medical care because of their unpaid bills often get sicker, then rack up even more medical debt when they need expensive emergency care. The act repeals the law that automatically transferred medical debt to a patient's spouse. No other kind of debt can automatically be transferred between married couples without their consent. But Minnesota law currently allows that to happen. It's unfair, and I believe it's immoral. Walt Myers will speak to this matter today.
Thank you, Walt.
The act bans charging interest on medical debt. Under current law, medical debt is treated like other kinds of contracted debt on which annual interest can go as high as 8%. This bill makes it zero. The act bans reporting medical debt to credit bureaus. Nobody chooses to get sick without having to pay the money for the care. We shouldn't treat medical debt like a loan someone failed to pay back. We shouldn't let medical emergency wreck someone's otherwise good credit. And I want to thank the governor for emphasizing that point. The bill has other provisions to make medical debt fairer: banning capturing tax refunds for medical debt, banning charging consumer fees for coding errors. You're going to hear a story about that, which is pretty offensive. Ann St. Martin will speak about that. Ann, thank you. Where's Ann at? There you are. And we're going to ban copay accumulators. Katie Drejos will speak about this. Thank you, Katie. Medical debt can and does affect everyone, no matter where you live or what you look like, how you worship, or where you vote. The unfairness in our system of collecting medical debt also affects everyone. It is a unifier, sadly. These are common sense solutions that everyone should agree on. And as I said before, the act covers two other important areas where we need to increase fairness for Minnesotans: garnishments and collections. These are important provisions of the bill, but they're not the subject of our press conference today. I don't have time to go into the details today, but we want to just make sure that everyone understands that that's part of this, what we're trying to do. Let me wrap up. I'd like to share a bit about how we got here today. Last fall, the Access to Justice Committee of the Minnesota State Bar Association produced a report on consumer debt litigation, and that report painted a stark picture of how broken our debt collection picture is in Minnesota. Katie Drehouse, here with us today, is the chair of the Bar Association committee that wrote that report, and I thank her and the Bar Association. The bottom line is that right now, our debt collection system can be both unfair and undignified. So last fall, my office started collaborating with stakeholders who are here today: the Bar Association, Pew Research, Legal Aid, the Governor's Office, Lieutenant Governor, Lutheran Social Services, Exodus Lending, a lot of citizens. We've had community meetings, and we came up with this legislation. We thank everyone for their contribution. We held convenings throughout the winter and the fall. We did it online, we did it in person, and we listened to Minnesotans. And we believe we have found the right way forward to have a fair debt collection system in Minnesota. That better way forward is the Minnesota Fairness Act, and I'm proud of the work that all of us have done together, and I look forward to seeing this bill enacted into law. And I'm very thankful to Senator Boldin, Representative Meyer, for stepping up enthusiastically to author this bill, and I'm grateful for the strong support of our governor and lieutenant governor, champions of working class people everywhere. Thank you very much. And with that, let me have Katie come on up. Senator Boldin. Oh, is it? Okay, Katie. Katie's up.
Thank you, A.G. Ellison and Governor Walz, for inviting me here this morning. My name is Katie Drehouse. I am the Access to Justice Director at the Minnesota State Bar Association. I am here on behalf of the Access to Justice Committee, and that committee is dedicated to advancing solutions that help all people, particularly people with lower incomes or limited access to legal assistance, to obtain the legal help and resources they need to receive equal justice. As A.G. Ellison said, in October of 2023, we released a report on consumer debt litigation in Minnesota. This came about because in the access to justice community, we regularly look about where the biggest gaps in representation are in the court system. And consumer debt litigation always rose to the top. Consumers rarely have representation in these proceedings, while creditors almost always do. In other areas where this is the case, in housing and family law, they have benefited from access to justice programs within the court, within the legal community, and consumer debt really hadn't had the benefit of those programs. So we wanted to take a fresh look at that. We looked at over 700,000 Minnesota consumer debt cases in the last 10 years and analyzed that data. We also spoke to stakeholders across the community to see what is happening day to day in those cases. How is the system working so that we could get a very clear picture of consumer debt litigation? And what we found was very eye-opening. Over half of all civil cases in Minnesota are consumer debt cases. And that means when a business or organization is suing someone for an individual debt. More than that, due to complexity, confusion, and those low representation rates, Minnesotans are largely not participating in that court process. This leads to having their wages garnished and personal bank accounts drained to ultimately pay that debt. Medical debt is included in these cases, which is why we're here today. And sometimes that's easy to see. If a medical provider is suing somebody in court, easily to tell that's a medical debt case. But other times that debt has been sold to collectors, or individuals put medical bills on their credit cards and then default on those cards, or they prioritize paying their medical bills at the cost of other debts that they owe. We also found that Black and Latino Minnesotans are being sued at higher rates than their white counterparts, even at higher incomes. And finally, our report mapped debt rates around the state. And this is not just a metro area issue. The counties with the highest rates of consumer debt court cases were in Greater Minnesota. And these recommendations from our report were aimed to help all Minnesotans, as is the legislation that's being proposed here soon. We are so proud of our relationship and partnership with AG Ellison's office. Their consumer team was involved in our report, providing expertise and feedback on key issues and serving on the diverse team that helped shape this report. Now they have taken key elements and included them in this legislative package that will help all Minnesotans, including bank account protections for Minnesotans so that creditors can't clear out a consumer's bank account, leaving them vulnerable to hunger, eviction, job loss, and more. And now to kind of transition from my professional life, taking off that MSBA hat and transitioning to my personal life. I am the parent of a child with a chronic disease, cystic fibrosis, and I also have firsthand experience of our health system. And after listening to some of the folks here today, I wonder who are those lucky few that don't. Even as someone with education, support, and knowledge of how to access resources, I've seen how one small mistake or one small fine print policy can cause incredible confusion, stress, and anxiety. People are trying to get healthy, stay healthy, or at the very least suffer less, and they're struggling to do so in our system. One small change that I've advocated for as the parent of a child with cystic fibrosis is that a copay accumulator ban. That's part of this legislative package. This legislation bans insurance providers from disregarding patient assistance programs as they help to fund a individual patient's deductible. This ban can prevent thousands of families from entering the debt cycle to begin with, while insurance companies still get paid for those deductibles. It's a big contribution to family health and financial stability. Particularly in communities like ours that require multiple daily expensive medications and regular specialist visits to stay as healthy as possible. So thank you again, AG Ellison and Governor Walz, for inviting me here today. And I am going to pass it off to Amy Martin, who's going to talk about her experience as well. Ann St. Martin.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Ann St. Martin, and I live in Invergrove Heights, Minnesota, with my husband, Dennis, and my two sons, Joe, who is 9, and Leo, who is 7. I stand before you today not just as a mother, but as an advocate for a bill that would provide much-needed reform to Minnesota's medical debt system. My journey begins when my son, Leo, at the age of 4 months, was diagnosed with a rare disease called Pompe disease. We spent the first year of his life in and out of the hospital, and we've had having 5 major surgeries. It was a diagnosis that turned our world upside down, not just emotionally, but financially as well. Rare disease affects millions worldwide, and many rare diseases do not have a treatment. Pompe is one of the lucky ones, and we do have a treatment. Leo receives an enzyme replacement therapy, or ERT, through a port in his heart every week. It's not a cure, which means that Leo will need to receive this treatment for the rest of his life. ERT can cost anywhere from $350,000 to $500,000 a year. And similar to other rare diseases, it's a multi-system disease, which means we have a long list of specialty doctors that Leo needs to see yearly for his care. My husband is a proud member of the IEBW Local 110 Union. The union works hard to provide good insurance for all its members. The cost of this good insurance is $1,500 a month. We understood early on that we would also need secondary insurance to cover the endless bills we were looking at. So we enrolled in the MA TEFRA program. We are charged $300 a month for MA coverage. To put it plainly, we pay to play in the insurance game here. We knew that our son's rare disease was costly, and we were doing what we had to do as parents to make sure he had access to coverage. In 2022, our genetics team came to us, and there was a new medication that they wanted to put Leo on. It was much more efficient. They told us they would start the prior authorization paperwork and reach out to our insurance. We were approved for the new medication a month later through our primary insurance, and we started the new medicine in August of 22. We were very hopeful for what this meant for Leo's quality of life. 2 months later, the day before his 6th dose of the new medicine, the hospital called and said that we needed to cancel our appointment, that insurance had denied the medication. So the hospital stated they would work with our doctors and our insurance, figure out the issue right away, and get us rescheduled. That never happened. We discovered that the insurance denied the claim because there was a billing code error from our doctors. The genetics team that I entrusted to get proper documentation, prior authorization for my insurance, made a mistake, and now they were billing me for their error. The insurance company then went back and denied all the payments for the previous 5 doses we had received. When I tried to appeal to my secondary insurance, they couldn't do anything because it was a billing code error. On top of all this, the insurance company dragged their feet, putting him on any type of other medication, leaving my son with a progressive disease with no treatment for 3 months. Once we got back on some kind of medication, I thought the situation was over. But to my surprise, I received a bill in the mail in April of 2023 for $250,000 from my insurance company. It wasn't just the charge for the drug that was billed incorrectly. I was charged for nursing fees, alcohol wipes, syringe fees, and all the other fun miscellaneous charges you get when you are in a hospital getting an infusion. Insurance was denying it all. The hospital was passing those charges on to me. And once again, my secondary insurance was saying they couldn't do anything to help. So here we are, paying $1,800 a month for insurance, getting no help from either of them. The genetics doctors and the hospital that I entrusted to do their job correctly was telling me that their mistake was now going to cost me $250,000. The hospital advised they would try to get the bill paid for in other ways, but in the end of the day, if they decide to send me an official statement, I have 18 months to set up a payment plan with them. If I fail to do that, they will start garnishing my husband's wages for the outstanding medical debt. As of today, we still owe $250,000. The hospital has not yet officially sent us the statement. I've called and complained enough and threatened, quite frankly, to anyone that will listen to me, that the hospital is appealing my denial with the insurance company, but we don't know how that will turn out. I pray every day I go to the mailbox that today's not the day we get the $250 statement because I'm not quite sure what we will do. For families like mine, the burden is not just managing the rare disease. It's navigating the insurance system, various doctors, and hospital systems that treat your rare disease. It is not lost on me that I am a white, college-educated, middle-class woman. I have the resources to advocate for myself and for my son. I know how to cause a stink, so to speak, and I make my voice heard. I am fully aware of the privilege that I have and my standing in society, and it breaks my heart for the rare disease families out there that don't have access to what I have. I can't imagine how hopeless and scared they must feel with a $250,000 bill. Do they choose between putting food on the table or paying a bill? Will they have to get a second job, taking them away from their sick kid just to pay for a mistake that a hospital and a doctor made? How is any of that fair? It isn't, and the reality is the reality is far too many families face that. I believe it's time for a change. The importance of medical debt reform legislation cannot be overstated. It's about providing relief and support to those who need it most, giving hope to those who feel like they're fighting an uphill battle alone. It's not about dollars and cents, it is about the human cost and the toll that the medical debt takes on all of our well-beings. Every child, every person battling an illness or a rare disease deserves a fighting chance. They deserve access to affordable care without the fear of being buried under a mountain of debt because of an error that a hospital system made. They deserve a healthcare system that acknowledges their mistakes in the billing system and prioritizes patients' well-being over everything else, excuse me. So I urge you in joining me to advocate for the medical debt reform legislation here in Minnesota. We should raise awareness about the importance of this issue for rare disease families and others. And I believe together we can make a difference. Together we can ensure that no family has to face the daunting and costly journey of a rare disease alone. Thank you very much for your time. Oh, and now I'm bringing up Walt Myers. Sorry.
And drop the mic as you walk away.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
I challenge anyone to.
Well, challenge accepted. Hi, good morning. I'm honored to be here. Thank you for allowing me to tell my story. My name is Walt Myers. I'm from Lakeville. I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. I'm an Army veteran. I'm a cancer survivor. And I'm also a volunteer for an organization called Cancer Legal Care. The reason I mention that is it's impossible to tell my story without telling you about them. And my wife, Sue, battled breast cancer for 23 and a half years. On January of 2019, her cancer, we were told by her oncologist that her cancer metastasized to her liver, and that while her doctor said that there are other treatments available, she felt that really none of them would do any good. And so my wife chose to stop treatment, and we entered hospice care. It was our wish to keep Sue in our house as long as possible, and the hospital helped us set up an in-home hospice team, and our family moved in. We had this kind of extended sleepover, and everybody was there. It was really a wonderful 2 months. During her 2 months in home hospice care, I received many explanation of benefits, EOBs, and sometimes the EOBs were 6, 7, 8, 10 pages long, printed on both sides with a long laundry list of services that were provided. On the first page was printed in big bold letters, "This is not a bill." I looked at the first few of them and I tried to make sense out of them, and if anybody can do that, more power to them, but I couldn't make heads nor tails out of them. So I just stacked them up on my desk, and the pile continued to grow. Shortly after Sue's passing in March, those EOBs turned into real bills, and sometimes for thousands and tens of thousands of dollars. And I couldn't understand how this was possible, because I had a high deductible of $4,000 or out of network of $9,000, and this was, you know, significantly more than that. And I didn't know what to do. I tried dealing with it myself. I thought, you know, who should I call? Billing, you know, insurance company, all these things. And the people I talked with are sympathetic, you know, to my story, but really nobody seemed to know what to do. Now, fortunately, I remembered a comment a social worker made during one of my wife's treatments at the cancer center. And social worker just walked by one day and said, "You know, if you ever need legal help, there's this organization called Cancer Legal Care that provides free legal services for cancer patients in Minnesota." And I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, why would I ever need that? As I was searching for answers, I for some reason I remembered that, and I don't know why or how that happened, but I'm sure glad I did. I contacted Cancer Legal Care, and with their guidance, their insurance expert was able to, we were able to find a way to contest the billings. We contested the billings, and after a few tense weeks of waiting, we got the word from the insurance company that the entire bill was forgiven. $135,000 of surprise out-of-network medical bills were gone, every penny. Now, I can only imagine, looking back, what my life would be like if I hadn't remembered that social worker's seemingly random comment that day. I'd still probably be making monthly payments on a six-figure medical bill that I didn't owe. Unfortunately, I'm finding out that my story isn't all that uncommon, and I really am one of the lucky ones. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you.
Good morning. I'm Liz Bolden. I serve in the Minnesota Senate representing District 25. I am really grateful to be here this morning, and I want to extend my sincere gratitude for everyone who is sharing their stories. Difficult stories to tell, but it's important that we're highlighting this issue. Throughout life, there are things that you can control, and there are things that you cannot control. As we have heard today, there are countless uncertainties we encounter in our journey through life. As a registered nurse, I interact with patients and their loved ones on nearly a daily basis. Medical bills and debt should be the last thing on their minds as they try to heal. But too often, for too many people, the thought of having their savings drained weighs heavily. A few months ago, I cared for a patient who had been in a horrible snowmobile accident miles away and ended up with many broken bones requiring surgery. By the time she came under my care, it was the fourth medical facility that she had been in the last about 16 hours. As the shift change occurred, the nurse who had been caring for her prior warned me about the patient's spouse, that he was distraught and difficult to handle. Within minutes of my entering the patient's room, it was very clear to me why he was so concerned. More than anything else, he was incredibly anxious, fearful, about how they would pay for the essential care that she needed without going bankrupt. He should have been able to focus on her care and her healing, but the fear of being trapped in debt was all-encompassing for him. This is just one story among thousands, with people all across all corners of our state. And stresses like these contribute to slower recovery rates, longer hospital stays, and higher costs, resulting in a cycle of compounding stress for the patient and their loved ones. Medical debt is certainly not the only thing that comes in the way of patients receiving the care that they need. There is so much more we need to do to transform our healthcare system to one that is truly centered around the care that people need and deserve. But in the meantime, there's also more guardrails we can create for Minnesotans to reduce the financial burden of unexpected health issues. All debt is coercive by its nature, but medical debt is a different form from other types of debt. Taking out a loan for a new business should not be treated the same as your health and safety. No one signs up to have their appendix burst or a heart attack or a car accident. You can't predict such accidents like you can predict how much grad school might cost you. Often we hear the phrase, life isn't fair, and that may be true to some extent, but we do have the power to make things a little more fair for Minnesotans. I strongly believe these proposed changes will do that and help us take some steps in the right direction toward a society that truly puts patients over profits. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to my partner, Representative Liz Ryer.
Thanks, Senator.
Thank you all for being here. I'm Representative Liz Ryer from District 52A, parts of Eagan and Burnsville. I thank the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and my partner in the Senate, and especially our testifiers today for sharing your stories. In Minnesota, we have a wealth of excellent medical care available for routine needs and to provide the most advanced treatments. However, many people have inadequate insurance or are uninsured, so they incur significant costs to access this care. Nearly 20% of Americans carry medical debt. It's 27.9% of black households compared to 17.2% of white non-Hispanic households. And it's particularly devastating when medical issues arise without warning and affect a person's ability to maintain their financial viability. 62% of bankruptcies are related to medical debt. My mom was one of them. She declared bankruptcy trying to pay my dad's medical bills after he passed. We've seen that patients and their families are harmed by unfair financial practices by the very organizations that are charged with caring for them. That's why the Minnesota Debt Fairness Act brings forward a robust set of reforms aimed at helping Minnesotans manage their medical debt. And I'd like to highlight just a few of the reforms. We're adding transparency to the system by requiring debt collection practice guidelines to be published. It's only fair for people to know what to expect as they seek to pay their medical debt. We're no longer allowing providers to intercept tax refunds through revenue recapture. We eliminated this practice in 2023 for certain hospitals. This bill makes the ban on revenue recapture for medical debt complete. Now patients and their families will know they can depend on receiving the tax refunds they've earned. And we're no longer permitting insurers or providers to hold a patient responsible for charges due to coding errors. Imagine this. If a restaurant charges us the wrong price for dinner, they fix the bill and charge us the right amount. Car repair shops don't charge us for an engine overhaul when they do an oil change and then say, oops, can't change the bill. The same rules should apply to healthcare. As you heard from Ann St. Martin, charging patients for coding errors is a real issue contributing to medical debt, and we're gonna stop it. I'm proud to be authoring this very important legislation in the House and to be partnering with my colleagues in the administration and the Senate. Together, we'll make managing medical debt more fair to Minnesotans.
Governor. Well, thank you all. Katie, thank you to the bar. For those of you, I hope you get a hand on and read the report they did, and the data is pretty stunning. To Attorney General, to you and your team over there have worked a long time on this. Thank you. This is exactly what the people's lawyer does of taking care of them, because again, I appreciate Ann's comments on this. Those of us who are in a position of privilege and still can't understand how to navigate this, imagine trying to do it if you're trying to do it in a second language or whatever it might be. It's virtually impossible. And I will thank the senator for saying that. Yeah, life might not be fair, but that doesn't mean we need to make it worse. And so really grateful to Walt and Lieutenant Governor and Katie. Thanks for sharing and trusting us with those stories. They matter. And my guess is to all the readers, listeners, and viewers today, you know you have these stories. You know this isn't right. You know the words that were spoken here are exactly what should be done. And I am grateful, and I have to tell you, I look forward to having you all back when we sign this into law right here. So with that, we'll take some questions from you.
Question for the lawmakers. Is this going to be in the form of one overarching bill, or are different elements of this going to be broken up?
The intention is for this will be one package bill. Many elements, as some of that have been discussed, but it's a package bill.
Will you be releasing the text of it today?
We are working through the process to get language back from the revisor's office. As you can imagine, there's lots of bills that have been drafted in the last few weeks as we are all getting ready for session on Monday. So as soon as the bill language and jackets are ready, we will make it available.
Is there a timeline you guys are aiming for, like a beginning of session introduction? Or are you guys looking more toward, like, you know, wanting to get this drafted fully, you know, over the next coming weeks?
I think our intention, I mean, this is a big lift. It's a big bill. It has many moving parts. It'll have to go through, several committees likely. We know we have a short session, and we are committed to getting this done. And so, we're going to move it as soon as we are able to and have the language.
Is this just a health care bill, or will other stuff be thrown in with this to get it passed?
I wouldn't use the term thrown in, but it will include other things that I mentioned, like collections and garnishment.
Attorney General, may I ask, a lot of these things are already covered in the agreement you have with hospitals in terms of restrictions. Why do we need legislation beyond what you have with the majority of hospitals in the state?
Because I think that having the force of law codified in statute makes it more secure, more dependable, and more foreseeable for consumers and everyone.
I'd like to add to that the hospital agreement covers hospitals. This legislation covers the healthcare system.
Do we have any states that have done this and survived legal challenges to it? Would we be out in front of the nation?
Other states have taken steps to protect and make a more fair debt collection system, and we'll get back to you on the details.
Maybe legislators, you spoke about the coding errors in the bill. How would the bill have affected Mr. Meyer's situation? Is there some provision that would have helped?
In the case of Mr. Meyer's situation, the difference would have been that he would have not been held liable for his wife's medical bills. Those would not have been transferred to him.
Do we have a sense of how many people are affected by medical debt now, and just how much debt is out there in Minnesota?
I was just going to say, and Katie, you probably should elaborate on this. Half of all the filings in our courts are involve medical debt. And Katie, you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, as I kind of mentioned in my remarks, it's hard to get an exact number because some of it is from those original providers and some of it has cascaded onto other collectors, or it reflects in defaulting on other loans. So getting an exact number, we don't have. We do also have a debt collection interactive tool that I can share as well, where you can identify cases by medical debt and what types of debt and different counties throughout the state. To get some more information, I'm happy to follow up and share that.
But can I just say, if you are saddled with medical debt or feel that you've been treated unfairly in the debt collection system, call 651-296-3353, because I got a feeling that there's a whole lot of Minnesotans who will benefit from a fair system. We were in Maplewood the other day on a weeknight, and there was, standing room only in the meeting. That's how much interest this bill has gathered so far. And we're going to need everybody to help us pass this bill, by the way.
Are there any current regulations on how long a health provider can take before they turn it over to a for-profit debt collector? Is there any limitation or time frame?
At this point, there's not.
They could wait 2 months and then give it to a debt collector if they want.
Well, my colleagues are telling me no, but here's another thing that they do. They hang on to it, let interest accumulate, and then file it on you so they can maximize even more.
An educational component.
Yes.
So, you know, somebody gets a huge bill so that they don't put it on a credit card, so that it becomes a different kind of debt that could only be discharged in bankruptcy.
You know, if I can be very candid, we're hoping that the men and women of the press can help us get greater awareness of how to deal with how to avoid some of these debt problems. I mean, we need more people to understand the challenge, but at the heart of the matter is not so much that people didn't know, it's that these things are unfair, but the education component comes in so we can help them avoid some of these traps.
For the authors, maybe Senator Bolden, you mentioned a lot of committee steps for this bill, but have you talked to, leadership and your caucus? Like, do you have the votes to pass this at this point?
So, I want to also focus on the stories of folks here today, and you know, we're aiming to highlight the issue. There'll be many conversations to come about votes and committee stops. We are as authors are doing the work to talk to our colleagues to be sure that we do and that we can move this through. And you know, I think it's difficult to hear stories like this, of which there are thousands across the state, and not realize that we absolutely need to do something.
Governor, do you have a stance on the North Star Act that was introduced yesterday? Have you been able to take a look at that? Sanctuary state bill, that one?
No, I've not looked at it yet. I think, you know, for many of us, this issue on border security, it is a concern for all of us. Every sovereign nation has a right to control its border, and Minnesota's always had a very humane approach to this. I think what we've seen is this is predominantly a federal issue, and what we've seen is the undermining of that by folks who simply won't pass what has been viewed by border control folks themselves as the most comprehensive package ever put forward. It's being derailed on politics. So I'll take a look at where that goes. It's a conversation that needs to happen, but Minnesota's always struck a proper balance on respecting the laws, but also respecting the human dignity, and I'll see what we get.
You're a surrogate for President Biden. Are you concerned by the special counsel report?
That he's been exonerated and there will be no charges brought?
No, that he couldn't remember like key dates. Yeah,
well, look, we got a binary choice coming up here. We've got somebody who's not going to be exonerated and who already has not been on 91 counts versus someone who has. So my concern is we got a president who delivered $1 billion on the Blatnik Bridge, continues to move forward on clean energy, and that's the position we're in. So,
the chair of the Senate Taxes Committee said last week that she had a one-word answer for people who came to her asking for her support for tax expenditures and new policies costs. And she said that answer was no. Do you have a different answer to those same people?
No, I don't have a different answer.
No. They want more than that. They want a quote.
Look, we passed and did a transformational session in last session, improving lives, sweeping lives in things from school meals. We were out yesterday talking about the incredible impact of the child tax credit, with over 89,000 children being impacted in the first week and a half, $111 million in tax cuts going out. I think we've got work to continue to implement. Our system is set up where a budget bill is in the odd numbered years, and these type of policy proposals and a bonding bill is done this year. And so I think it makes sense for us to look. The US economy is strong as anywhere in the world. We see deflationary pressures destabilizing China. I think now is the time to just implement, get things done, see the impact of what we did, and go on from there. So I think the tax chair is taking a very very measured, a very smart approach. We have had balanced budgets for our entire time in this administration, and we'll continue to do so. At this time, I concur with where I think the tax chair is at.
Does that then mean
this is the last one here.
Yeah. Does that then mean that the public option for Minnesota Care is out because there is a price tag on
well,
that?
Well, I think those are all discussions. These are in the initial stages, and I simply was asked on where I feel on this. That's the position of the administration, but I also know that situations come up that we look at, and we'll try and be measured about it. You've heard me say this since I've come in here. It's not what you normally hear. I always think it's taking a hard stand position before you hear everything out is a little bit disingenuous. On this one, though, I do think we've got a lot to do. I look at this from administration's perspective, and I've been a legislature, so as Lieutenant Governor. we're in the job of putting forward and implementing all of these good proposals that were put forward. And I think right now we're just trying to still move that forward. Look, we were supportive of this, and think that listening to Representative Breyer and I were here talking about this, is we're going to fix this issue around medical debt. But there's a bigger issue here, that the entire healthcare system, it's basically a fraud to call it a system, because it's a gaggle of misplaced things that doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It doesn't get us the best results. We rank way down in the world, even though we pay more than anything else. We're going to have a conversation on University of Minnesota healthcare and academic medicine. We're trying to solve these things in little silos or whatever when it's a bigger issue. So I welcome the discussion around the public option. What I'm saying right now is that I think we need to look a little longer term. This is not a budget year. This is a bonding policy year, and I think this is a time to maybe assess that and see. It's going to take building out consensus along this, and I think at a time when the economy is going to soft land, we believe, but it's still in flux, let's give it some space.
All right.
Great. Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much.
That was good.